From Public Health Institute, welcome to the PHI CDC Global Health Podcast, the podcast that highlights stories from the PHI CDC Global Health Fellowship Program, a U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention funded program implemented by the Public Health Institute. Our fellows are guided by CDC Global Health experts and work on the front lines of global health, developing the technical and professional skills needed to make meaningful contributions to today's global health challenges. I'm your host, Whitney Sturton Hall, the program's administration and communications lead. Our guests today are Lucy Ellis and Gareth Durant. Lucy Ellis is Program Architect for the Unnamed Road, which is part of Designing for Systems Innovation and Leadership, or DSIL, and she works as a partner at the Ready. Gareth Durant is a designer and facilitator for the Unnamed Road and DSIL. They share their background in public health and leadership training, their insights into improving leadership systems, and how they interact with our fellows. Welcome, Gareth and Lucy. It's great to have you here. To get started, could you chat about what DSIL is and what your current roles are, and then a little bit about your work with our fellows and some of the other organizations that you've worked with?
We are somewhat of a motley crew of people working in different areas of the world. That includes New Zealand. I'm based in Taiwan. Lucy's in the US, but originally from New Zealand, so it gets all very complicated. But we work on really interesting projects, either, again, in the leadership development space, so working with WHO or, you know, governments like the UAE, supporting the leadership development of either directors or regional level players in the WHO or just people working in the government in UAE. But we also work on some really interesting design projects where we're either a thought partner or like a strategic support. And those are things like, how can we design age-friendly cities? How can we design HIV programming that's youth-centered? So those are more of our strategic partner work. And a lot of it is in public health on some exciting and relatively gnarly public health questions.
I'm actually former CDC and left about a year ago now. And I came into the DSIL community by doing what is their kind of executive leadership program that's kind of a flagship offering that's part of the DSIL ecosystem. And I did that while I was at CDC with the support of my supervisor. And that was a transformative experience for me that helped solidify kind of where I've headed today, which has taken me out of CDC, but not out of public health and not out of the leadership space. And so kind of the role I ended up playing with this was to be the dot connector when I was given the opportunity to say, like, hey, we want to build a very provocative, bold, and disruptive leadership development experience for the PHI fellows. This is, you know, like an all new thing and a really exciting opportunity that the Center for Global Health wanted to stand up. I was like, I think there's only one place to go to find the kind of community that would be capable of designing and co-creating that with the fellows in a context like CDC, where there's such specific dynamics around power and equity that we'll get into later in terms of what does it then mean to really be a leader in this space or to cultivate leadership in this space. So I kind of have played like an architecting role in the background. It's been most of my day job, daytime working with another company called The Ready that works in organizational design and transformation, but very much, these sort of fields are intertwined. And I think that, you know, that's, we work in sort of blurry boundaries. And that's quite important to be willing to cross those boundaries to kind of get the work done and the leadership development growth.
Lucy is very much also a CDC whisperer. So having someone that has been inside the institution and then has brought in some new dynamics to this leadership design and our kind of portfolio of support, it's just been really great to have Lucy on board to kind of help us navigate also what this system is like. And I think that's a really exciting middle ground, that ambiguity. We're trying to do some cutting edge stuff, but also you need to know where people come from and how the organization is run for many years. So it's, yeah, she's also a somewhat of an oracle and a whisperer as well on the project.
I'm not sure I always whisper super well, and sometimes I piss people off, but that's okay.
That's part of the job.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's a great resume tagline, CDC whisperer. Well, before we get into more specifics about, you know, how you all work with our current PHI fellows, from a personal standpoint, I'd love to hear what drew you each to working in public health and how your career has progressed.
Yeah, so I think it's really important to be really transparent about, like, you know, I was in the global humanitarian sector, I don't know, 6-8 years ago, something like that. And I remember I was writing reports in the UNICEF Pakistan office for communications, and I had a mentor, the deputy in that office, and she was like, if you want to do things other than communications, you got to pick like a technical field and go get a master's degree. And I was like, gotcha. So I was like, public health or education? And I just was like, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, and I picked public health. And then I ended up, again, like not through any strategy or just life circumstance. I was trailing a spouse at the time. I ended up in Atlanta, and I was like, oh, there's this place called CDC. Curious. The mecca of global health. That's kind of handy. And then I like fortuitously ended up inside the Center for Global Health in the Division of Global Health Protection as an ORISE fellow working on what was called the Impact Program at the time, that was a leadership and management program for public health officials in other countries. So we were building leadership capacity. And for those who know the DGHP world, we were up there alongside the Field Epidemiology Training Program, which is kind of CDC's flagship program worldwide that they're quite well known for. And that was my first foray into leadership development, which also then led me into the organizational design and transformation space. But like, I think what I would say is like my career kind of progressed, but then I reached a point where I was like, I don't think it's about progression anymore. It's about like, I just got like circled closer and closer around this thing that I realized I love and I get on fire about, and I could spend decades chipping away at and never fully solve, which is sort of how do you eliminate like the shit that holds us back in these inside organizations, right? That takes up all our time and energy and depletes us of doing really courageous, creative, impactful stuff. But that, like, I didn't have some big strategy. Like, I just went where the energy was and where things got me excited. And I didn't pay too much attention to trying to be the first author on something or trying to, like, get some sort of accomplishment. I just kind of followed what got me really excited and had a few serendipitous things along the way.
It's interesting to reflect on because I think the earliest memory I have of a career direction was wanting to be a diplomat. You know, I was studying overseas. I was doing my undergraduate in Taiwan in Chinese, and I kind of thought like the next thing would be the foreign service. Then I realized I have no diplomacy, and it's really not a skill set that I have. And everyone around me that was already in the foreign service was spending their time like negotiating which zoo China got to send a panda to, or, you know, like, stuff that just wasn't really interesting to me. And then, because I spoke Chinese, I wanted to be an interpreter, and I was like, all right, I'll switch tacks and I'll do translation and interpreting. That's really exciting. And then I realized as an interpreter, you don't have your own voice. Like you don't have an opinion. And then I again realized that I'm quite opinionated. And after I graduated university, my first public health job was literally standing outside of a toilet block, handing out condoms and working in sex on premises venues as kind of a peer educator in the HIV space. And, you know, that is not discussed in your high school career counseling, as an option. And once I realized that, sexual and reproductive health as a sector, having honest conversations with people in the field in like really interesting settings was a possibility, that's when I decided, oh, obviously public health is for me. And that's when I kind of really realized that I have a knack for this kind of work as well.
Since you both have this global experience in cross-cultural work, you've also worked in health equity, equity-based design, and had various field experiences. Are there any moments that stand out to you as key learning points in your career that influenced the work you do today in leadership training?
I started out my career managing people in the humanitarian sector. Like, I very quickly was thrust into management roles at like the age of 22. And here I am managing, you know, Congolese staff that are twice my age. And like with next to no kind of attention to general leadership growth and management like competencies, let alone any sort of substantive attention to like the, you know, neo-colonial power dynamics going on there. And like, I saw how quickly you could find yourself changing. Like, it just gets into your blood what, you know, the dynamics, the power dynamics, you just kind of absorb them and start acting in those ways. You know, and I remember being in Congo and just, there is these like hangovers from the Belgian era that once I went to another country and managed staff in South Sudan, I noticed were not the same. But that, you know, there is such a complexity to cross-cultural leadership, and that the leadership development arena, especially in global health or in global development in general, leadership development in general is still so like corporate white male North America like centric, and there's a dismantling of the field that is going on right now that I feel like is what's so exciting about this program, is that we have intentionally like flipped it all on its head, and we're starting with the quote unquote bottom of the organization, and it's like, no, it's not the bottom, because real leadership happens in relationship, and it's about like not about your formal title. So like, that's just I've kind of like run out of like discarded, I guess, a lot of some of the more classic leadership content, because I'm like, well, does this shit work when you get to low resource environments where people have been marginalized and systematically oppressed over decades? Like, no, well, then it's not good. Like, this will not do. And so I feel like I'm constantly learning and always coming with a posture of curiosity in this space. And that is why, like, when I was given the invitation to sort of architect this program, I was like, I am not the one who knows how to do this. What I do know is how to find the people that I think could be trusted with such a delicate task.
Yeah, I think riffing off that, I think there's like a huge hypocrisy in leadership development in public health. And the sense is that, you know, headquarters teaches regional how to manage and lead, and, you know, regional teaches country programs how to do things. And eventually we get to the field work and on the ground, and, you know, we teach them that a Gantt chart or a log frame is how they're going to crack the system. And none of that is true. And I found in my work, I was so focused on the specifics of the kind of health output. So how many IUDs were inserted, how many people got, you know, whatever it was, like some unit of healthcare provision. And I wasn't really thinking about the systems, nor was I thinking about all the unofficial, informal, innovative ways that people are showing leadership. I remember being in the Solomon Islands, and we were dealing with a flood, you know, bridges were broken down, and within 24 hours, there was an entire economy of a raft system across the rivers where you would pay a very small fee, but to get yourself, your kids, whatever needed to go across the river, you know, like a pulley raft system. And these were like, you know, these were doors of fridges that had fallen off. These were, you know, bits of bamboo put together, but there was a thriving economy that allowed for a response, a solution to the problem. And then all of that was shut down because the, you know, infrastructure project was greenlit. And then, you know, they built the bridges again. We didn't even look at, hey, is there a solution that's already been bubbling up? Is there leadership that people are seeing in their communities that we just have to continue to support? And it was all these examples of that really made me say, you know, leadership and kind of innovative solutions to things are happening all around us. And it's not until we let go of some of our preconceived and very, you know, kind of going back to what Lucy said, these 1980s people management, you know, business centric, you know, Anglo-centric ways of leading, we're really going to see a lot more progress when we democratize that and just see it for what it is, that everyone is a leader in their own right in really different ways.
When designing this public health leadership program for fellows that you all have touched on a bit, what kind of competencies or methodologies did you decide to focus on?
I'm really looking forward to Gareth kind of sharing on this, but we kind of had five design principles that honestly just kind of emerged. I don't remember. I like literally just came, these five words came out and then I put them down on paper and then like the rest of the team then built them out into something that like there was something magical about how they came out that I'm like, I don't feel like that came from me. I feel like it came from somewhere else in the universe that wasn't me. And so we had the five things of equity, relationality, emergence, co-creation, and transformation. And those sound like super fuzzy words, especially to people that would so much rather just give me like a quantitative, I can measure that I have ticked the box and I can do the X thing. And you're like, no, man, I'm sorry. Like, it's just not how leadership is. Leadership's super messy. And so, you know, equity was front and center in that. And I'll let Gareth speak to that a bit more as well. Relationality, to me, I just saw time and again that like we don't know how to prioritize the relationships and think in relational maps in terms of what we're trying to achieve together. We get task oriented, not people oriented. You know, and some of the best, like the best leaders I worked with at CDC, I worked with two of the principal deputy directors in the Center for Global Health, Kevin Kane and Hamid Jaffrey. And both of them, I would watch like up close and personal how it was that they managed relationships. And that was core to what it meant to lead well. And I just think that it's often forgotten. Emergence is something that, I think people like can be quite challenging to wrap your head around. And once you start to wrap your head around it, can also be quite like scary because we would much rather have a plan that we say to ourselves, we're going to do A, B, and C on this timeline. But if COVID taught us anything, it taught us that like plans are just our like security blanket to help us feel in control. But like things are going to change on a dime. And if we don't know how to pivot and we're too damn attached to like the plan that we made, we're going to fail the problem that we're trying to solve. So there's that iterativeness. And then co-creation kind of in there with the equity piece is like, if we don't have all the right voices, if we don't have the voices at the table, like, who the hell do we think we are to build solutions for someone else? And again, there's a lot of dismantling of power structures there that that co-creation allows. And then that last transformation piece is that when it comes to like leadership growth as a person and as an organization, like unless we're talking about fundamentally maturing as a human being, then I don't really think we're talking about leadership development. Like if we're not talking about working through our biggest blind spots and our biggest vulnerabilities and then we're just like painting on the surface of things. So that's, and that when we do real leadership in public health, to me is the people that are like, God damn it. I am going to spend 20 years of my career fighting for polio eradication. And I am going to, like, there's not, like, I will not cease on this thing, you know, and then you have enough people that are driven like that. They transform like a whole disease or, you know, whatever aspect of public health it is that you want to solve. And you kind of need to have that pioneering spirit in my mind to really, like, to demonstrate leadership in this space. So, yeah, that's sort of my, like, quick take on it, but I would love, Garrett, to hear your thoughts as well.
Yeah, I think those design principles was a sifting of insights around what aren't we doing well and what are the critical conversations that need to happen. What if we were given free kind of range, what would we really want to do? Like, if this is a legacy project, if this is, we can build it from scratch, where would we go if we were bolder? So that's kind of how, we landed on those things. But if you look at them in juxtaposition to what's out there, I think it's really interesting. So if you look at, what are the competencies for a graduate from a Masters of Public Health or a DRPH, essentially there's different models. So for accredited MPH programs or kind of WHO workforce type competencies. But if you look at any of them, they have, quote unquote technical expertise, which is all your biostats and epidemiology and things like that. And then you have these kind of cross-cutting issues that are bundled together. And a lot of that is diversity, inclusion, or leadership, a very broad category for the competencies, and then systems thinking. And ultimately, as we deep dive into those, we wanted to pull out the ones that were, a little bit more radical and a little bit more where we need to go for the future of public health. I don't think anyone's post-pandemic lamenting that we didn't have, enough policy revision, experience or, where we're lamenting on things like how equitable is our society in general? How quickly can we build trust? What does the community say about that? Are they in right relationship with us as quote unquote experts? Did we allow for time to see the system emerge and respond without necessarily presupposing something or just saying, well, this is what it says on the ticket items, this is what I have to do. When we design a vaccine program to, do outreach or whatever, did we co-design it with the group that were, most affected or had a low level of trust historically with the government? No, we didn't. And did we really use this time to transform the way our systems are, running for the better, for the future, for any future pandemic or any other issue? Not really. We didn't. And so for us, it was like, if this is our moment and we have, such support by the infrastructure that brought us in to really go there, this is what we thought was most important. And it has been a rocky road because it's quite controversial, but it's also been so liberating as well. And that's what's been really exciting about the program so far.
Yeah, I love that idea that we're often focusing too much on tasks and need to focus more on people and also just needing to disrupt the systems that are in place. What kind of support do fellows receive in the unnamed road?
Given that Gareth is deeper in the execution on the work, he'll be able to give an even richer answer. But I think that I think the really key aspect of the support that they receive is that the design principles continue to play out in that support. So the support is co-created. Like, there is a number of ways in which the fellows have weighed in on what it is that they get in terms of support. There is like active conversations about the way that the support provided the equity implications of like certain time zones are having more challenges accessing the support, the relationality. Like, we are deeply committed to you as a human being and your growth as a person. And it's like, I think people are kind of unsure what to make of that. There's like an intimacy and vulnerability that comes with that. So that's really key. And then the emergence piece, for example, is that we had like, here's the program, here's what we're rolling out. And then we started, and then we like also added new pieces in that Gareth can talk about that, are meeting the needs. So there is this truly, we are demonstrating by the way the program is evolving in real time, the principles that we want to invite the fellows to learn to live into in their own work. And then that transformation piece around like, we're not just here to like run a bunch of trust exercises. Like, we are here to help you move through like what we hope are massive breakthroughs in your life. And I say that from personal experience. Like, I like the DSIL community and the coaching and the leadership experience that I've had with Katie Grenier and the others on the team is just has literally transformed my life. And I would not be here today and half of who I am if it were not for the deep work that I have done with them. I would not have chosen to take a huge leap and leave CDC to do full-time organizational design and transformation work, and then to be coming back and still serving in this environment, which was always what I hoped to do when I made that move. So so that's kind of like from the higher level, the ethos of the kind of support. But Gareth can speak more specifically, I think, to the actual nuts and bolts of that too.
Yeah, I think the ambiguity of the program has been a delightful challenge. It's kind of like being offered candy from strangers. You're like, what are you doing? What do you mean? What do you mean you're here to support me for a year? What do you mean I choose my own adventure? What do you mean I name my own road? And I think that, you know, speaks to, I guess, the broader system and what it feels like to be in more bureaucratic organizations that might be more hierarchical, where you don't feel like you are a critical, three-dimensional person who is on a journey to kind of self-actualize and have the most fulfilling career you have. But those are literally our starting points. So it's about saying, if you're only interested in advanced biostatistics, can we get you into a place where you're part of a community of practice so that you see some of those relational aspects of the work that you're doing, even if you're kind of focused only on those things and you only see that, you know, advanced statistics and field epidemiology as leadership. If you're really overwhelmed and kind of burnt out with your work and you don't have the bandwidth to get involved in a cohort based model where, you know, you go on a journey with peers and you learn from peers and we support you in that journey. We offer executive coaching, advising on specific topics. So you could be like, how do I navigate the CDC as an African American woman? What's it like to be black, a woman, and in public health? You know, what does it look like to be queer in public health? We start to say, like, how can we tailor and customize this program so that whatever support you're having difficulty navigating, that's the support that we make sure happens. Or it could just be a support pod and saying, like, well, this group are all based in West Africa and we have some cultural aspects of our work that we really want to talk and discuss. Let's meet every month to kind of unpack some of those things. So it's very much a build your own adventure, tailored support. And I think that was a really new concept where people were very, it was like a little hesitancy in the beginning. And then we've seen this complete change where it's like, so you're really here to just support me all year, depending on what needs to happen. And I can bring my, like, can I bring my work-related challenges to this leadership program and work it out with my peers and then learn from that and then apply it? And I was like, literally the definition of health, of leadership development in my book. So yes, absolutely. And I think it took a couple of pitches before we got the cohort on board to say, like, oh, wow, like, this is how it works. And it's not unit three, you know, lesson two, a video on people management and public health. Certainly doesn't need that. And leadership development has moved far beyond that kind of work.
That makes sense. People would be nervous. It's unnerving to be vulnerable and address issues in the workplace that can often have deeper roots. So you both touched on systems and that they can be flawed. So what aspects of coaching or mentorship do you feel are broken right now or in need of repair in the public health space?
I mean, I would almost say, like, I don't know if it's broken or in need of repair, but like just that coaching, how prevalent is that as a sort of support structure for the average public health professional, you know? And for those who then do have that, how do we know how to come to that support bringing our whole selves? I think what especially in the CDC context, I think the thing that, like, I know I really want to try to disrupt is that segregation of personal and professional, when it comes to your leadership journey and development, because I'm like, it's not even like, I think it's preferable to have an integrated approach when you do coaching and mentoring of the personal and professional. I'm like, it's literally not possible to, I think, develop as a professional, as a leader, and in an organization in a way that's really going to achieve like lasting integrated impact without attending to the personal. Now, there are people, and you can name them, and I won't name names, but you can name people who have driven enormous impact in global health. And the numbers are like absolutely astonishing and yada, yada, yada. But when you find out that that same person is also like ruthless and a bully and toxic and da, 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 like, I'm like, well, what have we done? Like, cool. We've like, you know, we've increased, like we've hit these particular, indicators in some particular disease, but in the meantime we've like mowed down, you know, the health system because we didn't give a crap about like these other four diseases, and we just treated like the, you know, the various like actors in the game, like the community health workers, as like little lemmings. And you know, like if you don't take a fully human approach to your own leadership journey, it's inevitable that somewhere along the line you're going to kind of dehumanize the work that you're trying to achieve together. So that's what I feel like is a bit broken, not just, I guess, in coaching and mentoring, but in the way that we think about leadership development. What about you, Gary?
Yeah, I think, so coaching and mentoring are relationships. So the relationships between a coachee and a coach, and obviously a mentor and mentee. So the fact that they are relational rather than kind of assessment-based or training outcome-based, they fit beautifully in that middle ground of what support people need for a comprehensive development of them as leaders. So yes, you can lean into recruitment policies and kind of how to get the right people. You can lean into 360 surveys that give you a sense of how are other people experiencing you. Like, that's absolutely great. Obviously, you need technical expertise. You need the ability to engage with groups of people. Some of that can be moved into a far more transformative space through kind of experiential learning and things like that. But you need to hold that learning in relationship to continue to grow, hold each other accountable and things like that. So it has a beautiful, beautiful place to, I guess, allow for the processing of individual learning, to not leave performance appraisals and critical conversations to the end of the year. It allows for managers to show up for a wide spectrum of issues that are happening in their workplace and then have a feedback model as well. So I think, you know, if you're not doing any of those things, you're doing a disservice to your kind of pipeline of leadership and things like that. But at the same time, I don't think you can coach or mentor your way out of structural oppression, right? So like there is something to be said for, you know, succession planning. So, you know, if I offered someone who was a junior career professional, you know, coaching in your first year, or I offered them to co-create a 3-year plan to get them to junior management, and what are the things that needed to happen in order to have a succession pipeline? And in fact, even had a conversation with senior management and say, where will you go for in the next 3 years? Can you go somewhere else and leave more opportunity? Or like, can you take someone under your wing as part of a 3-year plan so that they can take over your role when you left? So I think it has a crucial role to play in leadership development. But if you're really looking for changing the landscape of who is in positions, I think we need to go a little bit further to talk about, you know, dismantling some things, succession planning, ongoing support, different ways of completely changing the way we recruit and retain and promote.
And what about soft skills? What do you think are some key soft skills that help set our fellows up for success, or young professionals like our fellows?
That's a great question. I think there's been a lot of debate around the use of the term soft skills to begin with. And I just like to put it out there. A couple of other like terms we like to use are like transversal skills or whole self skills, which really to me signal like the skills that you need no matter what you choose to do, no matter where you choose to go, if you want to grow in leadership. You know, the transversal being the kind of these skills that cross over any boundary, really. And I think that they are, it's this combination of like, there's courage in there, because if you're going to really make an impact in public health, you are going to have to like be willing to go against the status quo and question like the way things are and say difficult things in difficult rooms. And again, that's what I watched and observed when I worked with some, you know, I feel like I had the real honor to work with some really sound leaders in the CDC environment. And I watched them make hard plays and speak upwards to those in greater power than them. So the courage piece is always there. I think there is also a humility piece and like this low ego thing of like, if people like are attracted to someone who is not there for their own progression, like people find it infectious and contagious, I think, when you meet someone who's like so committed to whatever public, you know, health cause or impact you're trying to have. And that's how you gather people around you that want to do this work together and how you build that trust. And then I think there's just this thing around like imagination and play and creativity and levity and humor that's also really crucial. Like some of the, you know, again, some of the people that I've worked with most that I so admire, you know, one that comes to mind is Barb Marston, who played a really key role in the COVID response at CDC. And I had the honor to work closely with her at times, you know, and those, you know, Anne Schuchat, who used to be the deputy of CDC, you know, when she was asked, what did she want to be when she grows up as a, you know, as an adult, she said, I want to write musicals. And that's what she does now. She's retired. And I always felt like the best scientists that I knew at CDC were also the ones that played music, wrote poetry, you know, like, so like did something with the other side of their brain. There is something really critical about having both sides of your brain like juiced up. And I think that's what I would say is really critical, is to look at your life and say, am I really exercising both sides of the brain? Because I cannot have one, you know, it's like breathing in and out. We don't argue that you should only breathe in, because if you only breathe in, you're going to die. So what does it mean to use both sides of that brain and both other ways of knowing, like somatic, intuitive, emotional ways of knowing are deeply undervalued, I think, in our context, compared to cognitive ways of knowing. So diving into that, I think, is really key. What about you, Gareth?
Yeah, I'm thinking about lots of different stories that come to mind, but one of them was hiring a country manager for Myanmar. We had just expanded our regional programming in the human rights space, and we moved into Myanmar, and we needed to hire someone on the ground to do our capacity building programs and kind of engage with stakeholders. And I was already running some workshops with sex workers and some other groups of people in country. And I basically just did a round of meet and greets with some of the candidates. And everyone was overqualified. Everyone was, you know, medical doctors turned public health and had done, you know, X amount of work with, you know, different NGOs and USAID and stuff like that. But there was one person, Kain Suwon, if she's ever out there. Hi, Kain. She rocked up. And while we were in the middle of a kind of workshop, kind of found her way at the back with a group of people and was just kind of introducing herself and chatting. And at the break, I walked up to her and be like, oh, I'm really glad you made it, et cetera. But she was halfway through swapping, I guess, makeup tips with a trans sex worker and just having a real laugh and having a great time. And it was very clear that I could trust her to engage with communities with dignity and respect, that there wasn't any kind of judgment or, you know, preconceived notions about these people. And that was very much the clincher for me, like, and very much the reason why I think these quote unquote soft skills are just so crucial to getting the work done. And, you know, you can be the best epidemiologist, but if you cannot engage the community and say, hey, this is what we're seeing in the data, but we don't actually know what the motivation is behind it. So like, I can only go so far and I need to engage people and take the leap. If you can't do that last kind of sense making and connection with community, or feed in some of that information to the community so they can use it outside the report that you have, you're a bad epidemiologist. And I think this is the kind of pushback that I'm starting to really push. It's that, like, don't put us into soft and hard skills. I would rather talk about how, you know, you're not doing your fully fledged public health job if all you're doing is looking from a very siloed perspective, and you're not connecting with what else is needing to be done, or you're not creating teams that are working together in ways that all their skills are utilized. So no one person necessarily has every competency and every skill set, but you're working in collaboration. And until I see all of that, I'm not really interested in a hierarchy of skills, because I always see it break down when you're not engaging community, you're not utilizing those relational aspects. You don't see the inequity in telling a group of people what to do without asking them what their lived experience is and things like that. So yeah, it's definitely something that comes up a lot, and I spend all my time trying to pitch, and I spend the exact amount of time trying to sell people on quote unquote soft skills, and almost the exact amount of time being called into organizations with conflict issues because no one has the emotional intelligence to have open communications with their team. So it's kind of like this weird self-fulfilling prophecy where they're like, these aren't important, we just want data analysis. All right, no worries. We all hate each other. Can you come in and help mediate? I was like, I see a connection here. Let's talk about that.
Right. Yeah, definitely a connection there. Well, in looking ahead, what do you think are some of the biggest challenges and also opportunities in public health leadership today?
Yeah, I would say that one of the biggest challenges and opportunities is getting strategic about investing in this space. So one of the things that I did when I worked on the Impact Program with the Division of Global Health Protection, so we actually stood up what was called the Global Health Leadership and Management Network. So we kind of gathered up like everyone we could find from different universities and organizations in the global health space, and we built out this like network of dozens and dozens of people running all sorts of leadership programs in all sorts of contexts with all sorts of types of public health audiences. And there was loads going on, right? Loads of different competency models, loads of different like ways of stringing the cat. And, you know, I don't think there's one single answer. There's also been a similar conversation going on inside of CDC in terms of bringing together all those that work on leadership development in some capacity at CDC and the different kinds of programs that you find around the place. And what we struggle with is like getting the investment to allow like, you know, more cohesive like research about what you know, what will move the needle on leadership development across the organization or across an ecosystem like global health. And instead of like starting, I mean, we started this pilot program, absolutely. But what really we also need to see is like, what is the leadership development strategy across the CDC? We don't have one. There is a small group of people working very diligently on that possibility. But I remember when I was in DGHP, I remember being like, what do we do in the whole of CDC? Like, we're just doing our thing in our little corner. Where's the bigger picture? And I just remember like climbing further up the ladder of the organization, just expecting to find this at some point and being like, wait, no one's done this? Like, oh, and that if it's being done, like every single person in the organization should know about it, because all of us should be stepping into leadership. So it shouldn't be hard to find. it should be provocative and digestible. So I think that to me is one of the biggest challenges right now. And along with that kind of goes, well, how do you conceptualize assessing that and measuring that? And that's where I think we are challenging the status quo with Gareth as an amazing evaluation expertise. And so do a number of the others on the team, Sarah and Heather and Nana, and really challenging the mindset around what it means to measure the impact of a program like this and not use proxy measures that lose meaning, because we just want to find a number that makes us feel like there's something quantifiable here. So that's a lot, but I'll stop there. Gareth, what do you think?
I think our biggest challenge in public health is all the baggage that we have from kind of like a hyper-medicalized colonial, background. So, leadership has to come from medical professionals that pivot to public health, and that it has to be, global north and all of that kind of stuff. So we need to let all of that go and let that go quickly. I think the other challenge is, we just need to stop. I mean, obviously celebrate the leadership that we do see in public health, and we have amazing leaders and amazing kind of new things emerging. But I think we also need to look at Black Lives Matter, and we need to look at, Hong Kong's response to democracy movements and things like that. We need to look at the ways that leadership happens in other spaces and really draw from that. I mean, public health is completely democratized, right? So every single person has had a visceral experience of the pandemic. They've had a deeply profound experience of good and bad public health wherever they are in the world. And so it has now permeated every aspect of their life. So that means that we can invite in more people. This kind of, ivory tower mentality that we have just really needs to be let go. And we need to look for inspiration elsewhere, but also get over ourselves a little bit, because everyone's, the PTA at your school is a public health entity, how your supermarket decided to add, alcohol wipes or whatever it is, that is a public health response. So we just need to obviously stay high with our standards of, academic rigor and science, but also just understand that we're all in this, and leadership comes from a lot of different places.
That's a good transition to the next question that I wanted to ask you both, which is that there's a lot to be overwhelmed about in global work or leadership work these days at times, especially when looking at disease and suffering, inequity, or crises unfolding like global conflicts. So what gives you hope working in this field when challenges can feel so large?
It's a really great question. I think it's important to start by normalizing the fact that disillusionment and a lack of hope and frustration sometimes is a very natural part of working in this space. And so in my view, leadership involves being mature in the face of that. I see a lot of people, there is a temptation to kind of give up on the big picture and the big game, the long game, and just carve out your little corner, get your, first author on this and that, and check out, and I think that it's important if we're allowed to own when we have those times and when we're really struggling, then that makes room to then keep the hope alive as well. It's sort of paradoxical, but then I find my hope comes from watching how I have been invited in to make an impact in a certain situation, because I've followed the energy that draws me in. I've followed passion and conviction and a gnarly problem, for example, global health leadership and what needs to change and evolve in that space, right? 20 years will go by and like, we still will not have ever solved that. It's a lifetime's worth of work. And I think that once we let go of ever expecting to reach some kind of end point, then we can be hopeful about the magic and the transformation that can happen in, like, the small moments and the small relationships that we work in day to day. And to me, that's the bit that really does matter. Like, you know, like, it's hard to kind of, I think it gets underestimated how important it is to be able to look back and say, you know what, we worked with, you know, these folks came together and we had some really amazing collaboration because we were willing to put aside our differences and we built trust and we had these breakthroughs and like that happened over this period of time. And then it came to an end because that was what made sense, you know, and just to let go of needing an end point allows you to then find hope in what happens in the now. It's a little bit of an ethereal answer, but that's what works for me. Gareth, maybe you've got something a little more tactical.
I can give a specific example, but I do concur. Like, you know, you don't want to go to toxic positivity where you pretend everything is fine, but you also don't want to go to the depths of despair. How do you find that middle ground where you can actually see the progress for what it is? I think, you know, one example is I did a project around engaging young people to design their own HIV service delivery pathways. And they hired me, an Australian consultant working in global health, who wasn't a young, you know, Filipino living with HIV, to run the program. And so that's a huge red flag for me. So step one was find a youth partner. So I hired a youth organization from the Philippines who worked in partnership to design everything and create it and drive the piece. There was a huge component of capacity building within that. So, you know, I might have designed the first, you know, co-design session. And, you know, future sessions were delivered by, the young activists, that have been brought on board for the project. And my goal wasn't to map or to create this service delivery, although that's what I signed in the TOR. My secret goal was that the next time something like this comes around, the group that I had engaged will be the first person that they call next. And it's little things like that. We did a write up and I was like, can we get, this young person, as a fifth author on this write-up? Like, what's the possibility? How can I support them to really engage with the material so that they can, move their career forward, but also kind of have more experience in this project? So for me, I had this kind of clandestine capacity building situation going on, as part of the project. And that's kind of where I've gotten the most joy and hope, because I can Trojan horse, these kind of things, because of the position I'm in. And so that makes me really excited, because I'm seeing tangible kind of responses. And then to go to a macro environment, I think, you know, 10 years ago, we weren't talking about decolonizing public health. Or, I mean, let's be honest, white people weren't talking about decolonizing public health. A whole bunch of brown people had been talking about it for a very long time. But we're a little bit more okay with critically looking at our systems and speaking that out loud. And so, I was able at the very beginning of this youth project to call that out and say, hey, this just isn't right. It's not going to work. It's not going to land well. I don't have enough context. I love that you have that faith in me, but you know, it's just not going to happen. And so we move things around so that it could be made possible. And I think the willingness for us to critique and then have ways to, move the dial, even if it isn't as transformative as we would like. I think those are really examples that give me a lot of hope.
Yeah, that's a great example. Thank you. And a hopeful note to end on, which is always nice. If people want to learn more about your work with DSIL, so Designing for Systems Innovation and Leadership, where should they go?
I can jump in here. Yeah. So you can check out theunnamedroad.io. So that's about the program specific to PHI and CDC. Or you could look at DSILglobal.com, and that's a bit more about our broader work in the leadership space, but also some of the projects like the one I mentioned in the Philippines as well.
Yeah, no, and I definitely just want to make a plug too within DSALglobal.com for the sort of flagship executive leadership program that I did, and that kind of led them to this organic program that was created. Because the thing about that that's really special is the cohorts are people from all over the world working on God knows what, everything, like from, you know, fishery stuff to fashion design to baseball. Insurance, baseball. I mean, talk about like what happens when you like put all of that in a blender of like building trust and vulnerability and growing in leadership. It's just like kind of epic creativity becomes possible. So I think, yeah, getting outside of your usual circuits and growing in leadership with totally random other sorts of people you might have never worked with is, I think, incredibly valuable to get us out of our silos and make us better public health practitioners.
Well, great. Thank you both so much for sharing. I really appreciate hearing your perspectives and your stories and lessons you've learned along the way. Is there anything else that you'd like to share?
No, I think it's really easy for us to, get into this professional issue where we dissect everything. But, you know, if I do take a step back, every time I get on a call with these fellows, I'm so excited to hear about their experiences. I'm so invested in both the challenges that they're seeing and navigating, but also just their resilience and their willingness to, think about things in a more, I wouldn't say altruistic, but a systems level. They are part of a system. They contribute to a system. They see the system for what it is, and a real willingness to make some changes. So I think we can get into this hypercritical lens with public health and where our leaders are and, you know, complain about our boss and, you know, the state of an institution or what have you. But like, there are good people in this doing the best that they can. And I think the more that we can start to unleash their potential, a lot of very quick wins will happen and a lot of really lasting impact. So I just want to say I'm really jazzed to be working on this project. I'm super indebted to Lucy for bringing it to the team. And then also just, I mean, if you said that I would be an MPH graduate who got to hang out with other MPH graduates to talk about our futures in global public health, I'd be like, you're kidding, right? That's a real job. I mean, similar to giving out condoms at a sex on premises venue, I'd be like, people pay you to do that. So just feeling really blessed today.
I just want to build on that too, just to say that like, what's been amazing about this is the journey that we've gone on together, like DSAL, PHI, and the team within the Center for Global Health, Felicia Warren's team, like all of us have been going through our own leadership growth journey. Perhaps you've felt this a little bit too in terms of how you've been pulled into this process and how like it's been demanding of all of us to like step into that ambiguity, and it's been beautiful to watch Christine and Mike and Felicia and their teams like step up as well. So like we have all been learning on this journey along with the fellows and their mentors. And so just seeing this kind of ripple effect is really beautiful. And it's, you know, I think we're learning a lot and we've got a long way to go still. But we're shaking the tree and sort of trying really new things that I think are much needed. And I just look forward to seeing kind of what the future holds.
Amazing. Well, thank you both so much. I'm looking forward to hearing more about the Unnamed Road from the fellows and also following your careers in the future as well.
Thanks, Whitney.
Thanks, Whitney.
Thank you to our guests, Lucy Ellis and Gareth Durant, and thanks to all of you for tuning in to the PHI CDC Global Health Podcast. This podcast is a project of the PHI CDC Global Health Fellowship Program, implemented by the Public Health Institute and its partner Consortium of Universities for Global Health, or the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Please join us next time as we share more fellowship stories. To learn more about our program and see how we are making meaningful contributions to today's global health challenges, visit our website at phi-cdcfellows.org. If you enjoy the podcast, you can always subscribe or rate us and leave a review, which helps other listeners find the podcast. For questions, please email us at info@phi-cdcfellows.org. This podcast is produced by Whitney Sturton Hall. Thank you to Mike Sage, Christine Caraballo, Felicia Warren, CDC Center for Global Health, PHI, and CUGH.